This is an ABC podcast.
I think Australia, in thinking about its military future, its future as a military power in East Asia, has to contemplate the clear possibility that the United States will simply cease to play any significant role in East Asia at all strategically. And if that's true, then it no longer has any need for an alliance with Australia.
That's leading strategic and defence analyst Hugh White. America, Hugh believes, is a great power in decline, no longer able to constrain a growing China in East Asia, nor win a future war against them. So what does this mean for Australia, for our regional security and our relationship with both the US and China? I'm Paul Barclay. This is Big Ideas on Radio National and the ABC Listen app. You've probably noticed all the talk about the possibility of a war with China, a war to protect our interests and America's dominance in the region, a war triggered perhaps by China intruding on Taiwan. Hugh White is concerned that Australia may be sleepwalking to war because of our unthinking alliance with America. He's critical of the AUKUS nuclear submarine announcement and our strategic and defence planning in general. In his quarterly essay, Hugh charts a path forward for Australia, one that takes account of China's strength and ambitions and our realistic options for dealing with this. Hugh White is Emeritus Professor of Strategic Studies at ANU, author of How to Defend Australia, and principal author of Australia's 2000 Defence White Paper. Hugh spoke to me at an event organised by Reading's bookstore in Melbourne, and we begin by talking about Australia's current relationship with China.
Look, I think the golden age of Australia's relationship with China that was characterised by that statement that every Prime Minister from John Howard up until even Scott Morrison on occasion said, we don't have to choose between America and China. What created that very happy opportunity when Australia could rely on China to make us rich and America to keep us safe was the fact that China was not, or at least was not seen to be, contesting America's position in the Western Pacific. I mean, if you want to go right back to the sort of prehistory of our relations with China to 1972, what made the moment of 1972 when Whitlam, of course, had gone in 71, Nixon went in 72, what changed then was that China ceased to contest America's position as its dominant power in Asia and accepted America as the region's leading power. So all the worries we'd had about communist China after the victory of the communists in 1949, those decades where we saw the communist China, red China, as the big threat to Australia, out of Menzies, Vietnam era, that was the era in which China was actively contesting America's position in the Western Pacific and East Asia. Then that stopped very abruptly when Nixon went to China. And that made it very easy for us to develop the relationship we had developed with China, extraordinary economic dynamism and so on, and at the same time maintain our relationship with the United States without having to make those choices. But when it became clear, crystal clear, unavoidably clear, that China was no longer accepting America's leadership, was now determined, because its power had grown, to contest the US position in Asia and to take its place as the region's leading power. At that point, and the historians will judge that we really only, well, I was going to say our government really only woke up to that in 2017, at that point it became much harder for Australia to sustain that balancing act that we'd enjoyed. And I think that's where the sort of present cycle of collapse of the relationship with China dates from.
This is under Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who you write, under his prime ministership, we'd become the most stridently anti-Chinese country in the region. Indeed, we'd shifted from under Tony Abbott as prime minister, when he'd welcomed Xi Jinping to Canberra and described him as a true friend and a champion of democracy. That's some shift in a short space of time, isn't it?
It's a very big shift, and I think the way to explain that is that, as I mentioned in my response to your earlier question, I think there was a lot of illusion, perhaps a deliberate self-illusion going on in the years leading up to 2017. I think, in fact, what happened was that Australian governments, political leaders, bureaucrats and so on, commentators, at one level understood that as China's power grew, its ambitions were going to grow, and it was going to contest America's position in East Asia. It sort of defied the laws of political gravity or strategic gravity that China's economy could grow like that, and it would continue to accept the subordinate position in East Asia that it accepted in 1972, when it's worth remembering its economy was smaller than Australia's. And so we went through this long period, which I think was just a straight period of denial, in which we pretended to ourselves that China was going to keep on accepting American leadership in the face of the very clear facts that its growing power and its growing assertiveness pointed the other way. So I think when Malcolm Turnbull found himself in 2017, I think particularly because he found himself with a US administration under Trump, which had turned anti-Chinese. And I think Turnbull was also at that stage facing a lot of internal pressures, particularly within his own party. He shifted from being, as I say in the essay, I think in some ways the most understanding, the most sophisticated analyst of the strategic significance of China's rise amongst senior political leaders on either side of politics. He swung from that to being an advocate of what I think turned out to be a very oversimplified, an overhyped and a counterproductive hostility towards China, which Scott Morrison, when he took over, then picked up and further amplified and drove us to the predicament we're in at the moment. Now, none of that's to say that China doesn't have a role in this. Of course, as successive prime ministers keep on saying, including our new prime minister, China's changed, they say, in a kind of complaining tone of voice, as if, how dare they? Well, yeah, they have changed. That's the reality we've got to deal with.
They've become a major power in the region, and as your essay makes clear, America's primacy in East Asia is now being openly challenged by China, who are now a major power in their own right. This brings us to our relationship with the United States, because we're in the region and we see ourselves as being protected by the United States, who up until recently were unchallenged as regional leaders in East Asia. I mean, where are we at with that? Is America essentially forcing us to choose America by virtue of that alliance, or is Australia willingly supporting America with the expectation that the US will keep us safe in these dangerous and changing times?
I think the choices are entirely ours to make, but of course we make them within a very clear framework of our own history and expectations and understandings of ourselves and even self-identity, our sort of understanding of the kind of country we are. And what's really striking to me is that as we've seen China's power grow and as we've seen China's ambitions grow and as we've seen China seek to do something which no power has tried to do since Nixon went to China in 1972, that is to push America out of Asia, to take America's place. That is extremely threatening to Australia's traditional view of how we function. It is a very important and very peculiar fact of our history, which we take for granted, but which in fact is very exceptional, is that ever since European settlement in 1788, Asia has been dominated first by Britain and then by America. And so we have never been in a position of having to make our way in an Asia that wasn't stabilised and made safe for us by an Anglo-Saxon great power, a great and powerful friend, Menzies' famous phrase. And what's special about this present moment in our history is that for the second time, we face an Asian power that seeks to push America out of Asia and seems likely to have the power to do so, Japan being the first, Imperial Japan, in the 30s and early 40s. But the difference between that occasion and this one is that Japan's economy, on its best day, at the height of its power before it was defeated by America in 1945, it probably wasn't more than a fifth or maybe a seventh the size of America's, whereas China's economy is bigger than America's. This is the fundamental fact that I think Australians, like Americans and many others, find it very hard to get their head around. We are now dealing with a China with an economy bigger than America's, and that's just a brutal fact that we have to work our way around.
So the figures you quote, China's economy today is 19% of global GDP.
Global GDP, that's right.
In 2035, it will be 24%, and the US will be just 14%. That paints a pretty clear picture, doesn't it?
That is the big number. And it is extraordinarily important, because in the end, wealth is power. And the idea that China, by 2035, which is the day after tomorrow, strategically, will have an economy which is well over one-third bigger than America's, is really, it is the biggest and fastest shift in the distribution of wealth and power ever. And that's what that means is that what Australia's done under Morrison and under Turnbull has been to increasingly cling to America, to assume that America can push back against China, can resist China's ambition to take America's place as the leading power in East Asia, to take us back to an Asia in which, as it's always been since 1788, in which their power makes Asia safe for us and saves us the trouble of working out how we can make our way in an Asia which is dominated by an Asian power like China with all the complexities that embeds. And the key argument I'm making in the essay is that I don't think that's going to work because I don't think America has either the power or resolve to do it.
Okay, so why do we assume that China wants to be a hegemonic expansionist power? And what do you see as China's intentions in the region?
Well, I think there's two reasons to think that China is going to has this ambition. The first is that every other rising power in history has gone that way. If we look at, the people commonly, and not unreasonably, look back at the, Athenians and the Spartans in the 5th century BC Greece. But if you look at the whole history of Europe, you look at the rise of Japan, you look at the rise of Britain as an industrial power, you look at the rise of America as industrial power, it appears to be one of those iron laws that rising powers seek to expand their influence. And in particular, what they seek to do is to establish within their own immediate neighbourhood a sphere of influence where they are predominant. America started doing this in 1824 with the Monroe Doctrine in the Western Hemisphere, and it's still there. It's what Russia's trying to reassert in Eastern Europe right now, of course. And so at one level, one can say that the reason we should think that China wants to do this is that it would be exceptional if they didn't. You'd need an explanation as to why they wouldn't. But the other reason, of course, is that's exactly how they've behaved. It's exactly what they've been doing. You know, for a long time, as China's power grew, they didn't do this. And they didn't do it for a very good reason. Deng Xiaoping had this great 16-character slogan, the heart of which was, bide your time, hide your power, don't claim leadership, sneak up on the bastards. No, I just added that last bit. but that's what he meant. I mean, the Chinese are pretty good at this stuff. It made perfect sense for the Chinese to bide their time and hide their power until such point as they were sufficiently powerful that their challenge to US primacy became irresistible. And I think the historians will judge that it wasn't until about 2008 or 2009, which happens to be around the time of the global financial crisis. It's also around the time when China's economy in PPP terms overtook America's. But I think there are probably several things going that determined that timing, and those two were just two of the factors. But I think, and it's not just Xi Jinping, whoever had been the leader of China over this last decade and a half would, I think, have felt that this was the time to go out there and assert, or you might say, of course, as they'd say in Beijing, reassert China's place as the leading power in East Asia. Now, the question is, so what are they really after? I mean, there's two parts to the answer to that. A lot of people, including quite significant parts of the Australian debate, including certainly Morrison and maybe the new government, it's not quite clear where they're going to, where they're coming from on this, they see China as determined to, use a slightly colourful term, rule the world. Mm. That is what they want to do. And Morrison talked about the arc of autocracy. There's a view that what China seeks to do in alliance or alignment with Russia is to replace the US-led unipolar order that emerged at the end of the Cold War with a Chinese-led unipolar order in which the whole world becomes authoritarian. I wouldn't for a moment suggest that there's nobody in Beijing who thinks like that, but I don't think that's a serious prospect. I'm very bullish about China. I think China is going to become the biggest economy in the world. I think those numbers you quoted, which are Australian government numbers, I might say, are probably right. So this is going to be a lot by a long chalk the most powerful country in the world, but it's not going to be powerful enough to dominate the rest. Mm. So I think what China really wants to do is to really take America's place as the leading power in East Asia and the Western Pacific, and to take at least an equal place in a global multipolar order. Mm. in which no single power dominates globally and the China is sitting up there at the top table, not subordinate to anybody else. It's a very traditional model of what a great power in the sort of traditional power political terms is. And I've had a lot of conversations with a lot of Chinese colleagues over the years, always in English because I don't speak any Chinese, but I've had a lot of opportunities to test their sense of where China is heading, and I'm pretty sure that that's where it is.
Mm. As I mentioned earlier, there's been a lot of talk about war lately, yeah. Hugh. Is China prepared to go to war to achieve primacy in the region, and conversely, is the US likely to respond in the same way?
Yeah, really important question. Let's step back half a step. What we're seeing in Asia today is the world's two strongest states are competing over which of them will be the dominant power in the world's most dynamic and prosperous region. So the stakes don't get any higher than this. This is very high stakes indeed. And these are the kind of stakes for which great powers have traditionally gone to war with one another through history. And actually, great powers don't go to war with one another very often, for very good reason. Great powers are very dangerous adversaries. Great powers go to war with little powers all the time. That's easy. Going to war with other great powers, it's a very sober thing to do. But the thing they go to war over is this question of, am I a great power or aren't I? And so that sort of is a starting point. When we see a contest like this, we should immediately be on alert. On the other hand, it's certainly not true that it makes war inevitable. There is a kind of an argument. People talk about the Thucydides trap, going back again to the example of Athens and Sparta, that when a rising power like China challenges an established power like America, war becomes inevitable. That's certainly not true. But what is inevitable is that war, or the prospect of war, or the threat of war becomes central to the way in which the contest plays out. Neither side wants war, neither in Beijing nor in Washington, but both hope to use the threat of war to encourage the others to back off. So China hopes that if it muscles up and convinces the United States that for the United States to preserve its position in Asia and to defeat China's challenge, it will have to fight China. The Chinese hope that that'll make the Americans back off. And the Americans hope that if they do the same thing and convince the Chinese that if they're going to push America out of Asia, going to try and push America out of it, they'll have to fight China to do it, that the Americans will back off. And so both sides hope that the threat of war will make the other back off. And of course, they might be right. Mm. I personally think the most likely outcome in Asia over the next few years, and I do really mean few years, I don't think we've got very long to run on this story, is that the situation will arise in which America is faced with the question whether it's really prepared to fight China or not and will decide not to and back off. Mm. But the trouble with these situations is that the two sides can miscalculate. And the issue upon which they're most likely to go to war is over Taiwan.
Yep, which we'll talk about in a minute.
And the issue and the question is whether the two sides risk a serious miscalculation of one another's resolve. China decides to have a go at Taiwan, expecting America to back off. America pushes back, expecting that the Chinese will back off. Neither side back off.
But
and
surely,
they both find themselves in a conflict.
Surely neither side can expect to win a war in East Asia, because winning a war between two nuclear powers seems inconceivable. And to that end, then, what is the difference between the current situation that we face and the Cold War situation between the United States and the Soviet Union, which was incredibly scary, but actually there was no conflict in the end?
No, that's exactly right. It's a really important question, because we do have this sort of massive case study of two nuclear armed powers facing off against one another, and they did it for 45 years and it never came to blows. But the reason for that is that the order of in the Cold War was a bipolar order in which we had two equal superpowers. Now, they weren't equal in every respect, but they had equal status. And so the Soviet Union had its sphere of influence, the United States had its sphere of influence, and the distinctive thing about the Cold War was that both sides understood that the other side would certainly go to war to defend their sphere of influence. And so neither side ever dared to intrude on the other sphere of influence. There were a few scary moments on some ambiguous points. The Russians weren't sure that the Americans would really go to war over West Berlin during the successive Berlin crises, but actually the Americans persuaded that they would. the Russians very unwisely decided, or at least Khrushchev unwisely decided, the Americans might not go to war over Cuba. Well, they got that wrong. But the other cases, places like Afghanistan, were grey areas. Or the other crises, for example, that the Russians invaded both Hungary and Czechoslovakia, but they were clearly within their own sphere of influence. So I think that the difference was in the Cold War, we had two clearly demarcated spheres of influence, and both sides understood that the other would certainly go to war. In other words, the strength of resolve, the balance of resolve, was equal. The difference in the present situation is that the United States claims a sphere of influence in China's backyard, in East Asia. And so that doesn't mean that China has equal status with the United States. It means that China, in America's model, has a subordinate status to the United States, and China seeks to achieve the kind of equality that the Soviet Union had. And the secondary consequence of that is that they don't have the equality of resolve that the two sides had during the Cold War. The Chinese, I believe, genuinely think that the United States will back off in a war over Taiwan. And the Americans, I fear, some of them still believe that the Chinese will back off in a war over Taiwan. And that's what makes the situation so dangerous. And there's an analogy here with what happened in the First World War. None of the great powers in Europe in the first days of August 1914 wanted to go to war with one another. But they all thought they could achieve their objectives by threatening to go to war and watching the other guy back off. And they were all wrong. Everyone decided to go to war. And so it's the possibility that we find ourselves again in that kind of situation which makes the present predicament, I think, so dangerous.
I'm talking to Hugh White about his quarterly essay, Sleepwalk to War, Australia's Unthinking Alliance with America.
So China's been able to look at how America has responded, or in fact not responded, to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. America made it clear that there would be no military intervention on their part in Ukraine. Would Beijing be thinking now that it's tempting to test America's resolve about Taiwan, that if it started to make incursions into Taiwan, perhaps America would take the same approach and not intervene?
Yes, I think that's very much the danger. I mean, consistent with the logic of that we were just describing, the key judgment for Beijing as to whether or not it moves militarily against Taiwan is whether or not how confident it is that America would fight back. And the more confident the Beijing is that the Americans would in the end abandon Taiwan, the more tempting they'll be to have a go. And I think the reasons that Beijing has to expect America to back off are quite strong. The most important of them is that they believe, I think correctly, that today, unlike where we were 10 years ago or 20 years ago, America can't win a war with China over Taiwan. And it's quite hard to convince someone that you're going to fight a war that doesn't look like you're going to win. But the other reasons are that they've seen a lot of evidence coming out of the United States, particularly under Trump and Biden, of the United States simply not being willing to bear the burdens and pay the price of the kind of war we're talking about. And Donald Trump's such a weird political phenomenon that it's tempting to dismiss some aspects of his personality and policy positions are just too wacky to be taken seriously. But actually, you know, there's something very important about Trump in what he meant about America as an international actor. Because it had always been believed before that you simply couldn't get elected in America if you didn't acknowledge and uphold the vision of America's global leadership that emerged at the end of the Cold War. And Trump just trashed that completely. He just said, I don't care about that stuff. And he really didn't. And yet Americans voted for him and voted for him again. And Biden took over, and Biden campaigned for that election to the extent he talked about foreign policy at all. What he talked about was a foreign policy for the American middle class, where we would do nothing in foreign policy that wasn't directly related to the welfare of the average American family. And it's pretty hard to argue that defending Taiwan is really significant for the average American family. Then you have the evidence of the way Biden conducted himself in relation to Afghanistan, and then you've got Ukraine. Now, what we focus on in Ukraine is the fact that lots of non-military support, non-combat support, has been provided to Ukraine to respond to the Russians. But to me, the really important thing is that absolutely, categorically, at the beginning, on day one, or indeed long before day one, back in December, Biden said the United States will not fight for Ukraine. And that is a very significant signal to send. And I'm not saying it's wrong. I think it was the right decision to make. But if you're sitting in Beijing and you're making that calculation, you know, are the Americans going to fight for Taiwan or not? I think it will very strongly support those in Zhongnanhai in the Chinese leadership compound who would be arguing that they could move against Taiwan and America would back off.
Well, Putin, one would imagine, made that assessment before Russia went in to Ukraine.
Well, it's an interesting question whether Putin made that assessment before Biden said it. I mean, I think there's an argument that if Biden hadn't said it as categorically as he did back in December, Putin would not have moved or would not have moved in the way he did. Mm-hmm. I think it would be quite likely that Putin would have done what he's doing now, and that is sought to expand Russia's control over the Donbass and down the Black Sea coast. I think it's quite likely that he wouldn't have launched the sort of full-scale invasion directed at Kiev that was what he launched in February and then backed off from halfway through March.
So you portray in the essay the US as a declining global and economic power, and you remind us that in the past, Australia has failed to foresee that the UK would not be strong enough to protect us in Asia in 1941. What is the lesson for Australia now, and what does it and should it mean for our alliance with the United States if we cannot assume that they will retain primacy in East Asia and therefore be able to protect us no matter what?
Yeah, it's a really important question. The United States is a declining power relatively. It is a country with a lot of troubles.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we could spend all night talking about that. But as a strategic actor, it remains a fantastically powerful country with a huge economy and tons of technology and lots of dynamism and all of that.
But not an unchallenged sole superpower as it was after the Cold War.
Exactly. That's exactly right. The fact is we've all, over the last 30 years, absorbed this idea of a unipolar global order dominated by the United States, which was unchallengeably preeminent in every dimension of national power. You know, economic, technological, military, ideological, and so on. And that image is just wrong. And it's one of the peculiarities of our situation is that it's taken us, and I think it's taken Americans and a lot of Europeans and a lot of others, so long to realise what the significance of the bare arithmetic. China's economy is already way bigger than America's, and the numbers you mentioned before is going to get much bigger still. And so relatively, and in the strategic business, relativity is what counts, relatively America is in decline. That does just, to me, make it extremely hard to see that the United States can effectively resist China's challenge to the United States in East Asia for long. And therefore, it means that Australia really does have to start thinking about how it positions itself to thrive, prosper, survive at least, in an East Asia in which the United States is no longer dominant.
That's a leap of imagination required, isn't it, for Australia. What does that mean for us if defence thinkers are thinking, as you are right now, that China is moving towards a situation where there are challenging, if not outright taking primacy in East Asia? That means that the attraction of the US alliance in terms of its ability to protect us is diluted. What would you then be thinking if you were a defence thinker about rearranging your strategic priorities accordingly?
There's two dimensions to this. There's a diplomatic dimension and a military dimension. I mean, let me deal with the military dimension first. I think Australia, in thinking about its military future, its future as a military power in East Asia, has to contemplate the clear possibility that the United States will simply cease to play any significant role in East Asia at all strategically. Now, most people find that impossible to believe, or possible to imagine at any rate, and I think that's a mistake. America has been a very active strategic player in East Asia for 100 years, but 100 years, things change.
But they would voluntarily step back,
They would find themselves confronted with China that they can't contain, and they'll find that they confront a choice between pushing back really hard against China with the risks of war we've talked about, a war which could easily go nuclear, and faced with that, they'll decide to step back. And the process whereby that happens is quite complicated. It depends on the trajectory of the Japanese alliance with America in particular. But I think the one way and another, I think it is quite likely that when we look forward, say, 25 years, the United States no longer plays any significant strategic role in Asia. And if that's true, then it no longer has any need for an alliance with Australia. And so I think the working hypothesis for Australian defence planning should be that we need to position ourselves, build the forces we need, to defend ourselves independently in an Asia in which the United States is no longer playing a significant role. Now, that is a complete shift from everything we've done before. Australia has never contemplated defending itself independently against major powers before. And a lot of people, including a lot of people in the defence establishment, simply say it can't be done. Now, Maury was kind enough to publish a book of mine a couple of years ago called How to Defend Australia, in which I said, well, let's just test that. Let's just go back to basics and see whether it can be done. And the answer I came up with was, yes, I think it can be done. It's very difficult. It involves some very difficult choices. It involves quite a lot of money. I would say something like 3.5% or 4% of GDP. But it's not unthinkable money. It's, you know, it's the sort of money that...
Which is basically a doubling of defence spending?
Yes, it's a doubling of defence spending. And it involves a very different kind of force structure from the one we're talking about at the moment to achieve very different kinds of operational objectives and achieve very different kind of strategic objectives. But I think it can be done. And so I think one of the things that Australia should be doing, and one of the things we should be doing differently from what we're doing today, is that instead of doing as we are, increasingly building out our armed forces specifically to support the United States in a war with China, which I don't think they can win, I think we should be building our armed forces specifically to improve our capacity to defend ourselves from the forces that a major Asian power could project against us. And that's a big, it's huge, very demanding national project. It would take a long time to do, but it's not impossible. But it would require us to rethink the kind of strategic player we are. We just haven't thought of ourselves in those terms. That's the military side. On the diplomatic side, I think we have to start thinking for ourselves, how do we make our way in an Asia which is no longer dominated for us by the United States? And that requires us to do two things. The first is, we need to stop going out to our Asian friends and allies and reading Washington's talking points to them. Because at the moment, the primary focus of Australian diplomacy in East Asia at the moment is to tell our neighbours in the region that what they really need to do is to do what we're doing, and that is support the United States at all costs against China. And there's two problems with that. The first is, for the reasons we've discussed, I don't think that's going to work. The second is they don't believe it. We're becoming less and less significant player in the regional strategic diplomacy in Asia at a time when we want to become more and more engaged with them, because one thing we can be absolutely sure of is that we find ourselves, as I'm pretty sure we will, living in a region in which China is a dominant power. The task for us, as for all of our neighbours, is to manage that as best we can, to reduce its negative impacts on us. And there are going to be lots of opportunities for us to work with other countries in the region to do that. And we want to maximise those opportunities and lay the foundations to do that today. The other thing we need to bear in mind is that whilst we've focused on China, and naturally and quite properly, China is only one of two or three Asian great powers we're going to have to deal with in the next few decades. The second of them, of course, is India. And you notice I keep on saying China is the dominant power in East Asia and the Western Pacific, because I don't think China is going to be the dominant power in Asia, because India is going to be too strong for China to dominate. And I think the region we're going to end up living in is one in which China is the dominant power in East Asia and the Western Pacific, and India becomes the dominant power in South Asia and the Indian Ocean. And we're going to have to deal with, at the moment, we tend to see India through the Quad and that sort of thing, primarily as a country that's on our side against China. And I think that's a very mistaken way to see India. India is on India's side, and it will certainly be against China to the extent that China seeks to intrude into what India sees as its sphere of influence in South Asia and the Indian Ocean. But I don't think it's going to take a lot of skin off its knuckles helping us to prevent China becoming the dominant power in East Asia and the Western Pacific. That's not really India's problem. What I think we're going to do is to find ourselves with two great powers, both of them behaving as great powers always do, both of them seeking to draw us into their sphere of influence, both of them trying to compete with the other. And that's going to be scary in some ways, having two great powers to deal with, but also kind of gives us opportunities, because when you've got a great power on each side of you, you can play them off against one another. And learning to do that, complex, difficult, demanding diplomacy, but that's what small and middle powers like Australia have to do. The third potential great power is Indonesia. This is the other great blind spot in Australia's strategic outlook. Well before the middle of this century, Indonesia will have the fourth biggest economy in the world. It will have the material foundation for being a great power. Now, if we look at Indonesia today, it doesn't sort of look and feel like a great power. And there remains a question, much more than in relation to India or China, as to whether it will have the kind of national resolve and culture and infrastructure, governmental infrastructure, to function as a great power. But it might. And even if it doesn't, it's still going to be a very significant player and ultra significant for us because it's so close. We'll have a great power right next door to us. So the, you know, a very important part of improving our regional diplomacy is going to be, in particular, to build the kind of relationship with Indonesia which is going to work for us and help us manage our relations with those two other great powers and make sure that we don't end up with an adversarial great power right on our doorstep.
I'm speaking to Hugh White, author of Sleepwalk to War, a quarterly essay.
I mean, a lot of these decisions are based on the assumption that the people in defence making the decisions, doing the thinking, accept the assumption that you've made, that it's inevitable that the United States will withdraw from the region, will no longer be the dominant power in the region. Is there any suggestion that that message is coming out from America in any way, or that there is anybody within defence who is starting to think about that being a possibility in the next decade or so?
None whatsoever. I really do think that right at the heart of our problem is that and I talk about this in the essay in slightly polite terms because I hope they're still my friends, they're certainly my former colleagues. I do think there's a major problem in Canberra at the moment, and it's not just the bureaucrats, it's also ministers, senior politicians on both sides of politics, really do find it very hard to contemplate the possibility that America is going to fail us. And one of the most distinctive things of what's happened in the last few years, and AUKUS is the sort of, you know, ultimate demonstration of this, is that as China's challenges become more and more overt and more powerful, as America's response has been, as I believe it has been, very inadequate, I think the way in which America's attempted to respond to China since that 2017, where it declared China as a strategic rival, has been extremely flaccid. But nonetheless, we have drawn closer and closer to the United States because we've found it harder and harder to imagine that the United States would fail us. And so we're in this really sort of, you know, potentially catastrophic situation that we're clinging more and more closely to an ally which is going to deliver less and less to us. And at the same time, that ally is demanding more and more of us. And so...
And we are making big decisions based on that assumption, not the least of which recently has been the decision to purchase nuclear submarines under the AUKUS deal. Perhaps we should talk about submarines, actually.
Yep.
We haven't got a lot of time left, and this is an issue that has been discussed a lot in the media. Our Collins-class submarines need replacing. We've made successive decisions about what to replace them with. Firstly, of course, the French submarine deal, which, as we know, we know what happened there. Then, more recently, the AUKUS nuclear submarine deal. You say two things. Submarines really matter, firstly, for our defence, very important, but that we still haven't got this decision right. What have we got wrong?
Right. Well, let me just say on the first point that I said before that Australia can defend itself independently if we build the right kinds of forces to achieve the right sort of objectives. And the reason I think submarines are so important is that I think they are one of the most cost-effective ways of achieving what is the most important strategic operational objective for us, and that is preventing other countries projecting power by sea towards us or our close neighbours. That's what submarines do. They stop other people using the sea by going out there and sinking ships. And one of the differences between my vision of Australia's defence needs and almost everybody else's is that I don't think we need 6 or 8 submarines or even 12 submarines. I think we need 24 or 36 because numbers really count. And I think we just need to get a lot of submarines out there into our maritime approaches. The problem we've had and the difficulties with replacing the Collins go back nearly over 20 years now, is that we haven't been clear in exactly what we want our submarines to do. And progressively, and this goes back to what we were just talking about, progressively over that 20 years, we've become more and more attached to the idea that the primary role of Australia's submarines is to support the United States in a war with China, rather than to defend Australia independently. And the more we go down that path, the more we've found ourselves thinking, we want a submarine just like America's, to do what American submarines do, which of course I think is wrong. And in particular, the submarines we're buying at the moment, the French submarines we were going to buy, the nuclear submarines we're now talking about buying, are specifically designed to support the United States in a war with China against the Chinese submarines in the South China Sea, which I don't think is what we should be doing. That's one problem. The second problem is that because we've been driven in that direction, we've ended up trying to develop submarines which have been extremely expensive, extremely complicated, extremely risky. The French submarine was an extremely ambitious design. We took a nuclear-powered submarine design, decided to take the reactor out of it and put conventional powertrain in, diesels and diesel engines and electric generators. That was always going to be a very complicated task. I always thought it was a really dumb idea, and they were going to be incredibly expensive submarines, unbelievably expensive conventional submarines. And I criticised the French deal very strongly. Now we've done something even dumber. The nuclear submarines are wonderful things. They have some very distinct advantages. In particular, they go really fast, but they're much faster than conventional submarines underwater. But they are extremely expensive and extremely difficult to operate, very demanding to operate. I mean, this is a nuclear reactor we're talking about. And my argument has always been that the operational advantages that you get from that extra speed from a nuclear-powered submarine are not sufficiently great to justify the additional cost.
Not to mention the fact that the new Defence Minister, Richard Marles, today admitted that Australia won't have one of these nuclear submarines in the water until the 2040s. You say, actually, we're probably looking at the 2050s in terms of an operational fleet of those submarines.
Yes, a really, really important point. Our Collins-class submarines are already running out of life. And the most optimistic interpretation is that we'll get our first nuclear-powered submarine sometime in the early 2040s. And that's if everything goes right. And everything never goes right in submarine projects. But exactly as you say, I make the point in the essay that that's the first submarine. But one submarine is no more a capability than having one wheel on a car helps you get anywhere. We know the minimum operationally viable, strategically significant number for an Australian submarine fleet is 6 submarines. That's why we have 6 submarines at the moment. And we won't have 6 submarines until the mid-50s. Now, this is 2022. That's 30 years away. We are in grave danger of completely losing our submarine capability in the intervening years. And so at the period of most strategic risk, we are going to be losing one of our most significant capabilities. So what should we be doing? We should be going out there and buying a new class of conventional submarines. My own argument, the argument I made in How to Defend Australia, and I touch on it again in this essay, is that the best thing for us to do is to buy an evolved version of the Collins submarine for the simple reason that we know the Collins submarine really well. And so that lowers our risks. It's a good boat. It's a big boat. It works. It meets our primary operational objectives pretty well. And we can get it for a lot cheaper, probably somewhere around $2 billion a boat. That doesn't sound cheap when you say it like that.
But what you're saying is that after scrapping the French submarine deal, we should now scrap the AUKUS nuclear submarine deal.
Well, remember that the AUKUS what's called the AUKUS nuclear submarine deal so far is a press release.
Okay.
I mean, there's no contract. It is just a gleam in the Prime Minister's eye. And, I mean, we don't necessarily have to scrap it. We could just push it out into the distance. Yep. But the other point, it's worth making the point that AUKUS is not just a submarine deal. It's also a statement of strategic commitment. And I think people haven't focused enough on this. Australia, of course, has been a close ally of the United States all the way since, well, 1941. But we've always worked quite hard to maintain a fairly big degree of strategic wiggle room as to what we actually do in relation to supporting the United States. And that was true right up into, even into Scott Morrison's prime ministership. You can see, I quote, I think, in the essay, that in 2020, Maurice Payne was still at pains to say that our policy in response to China is different from America's, that we wouldn't necessarily do everything the United States was doing and so on. And what struck me when the AUKUS announcement was made in September last year, how all of that moderation disappeared. That the AUKUS deal, viewed as a strategic proposition as rather than a capability proposition, was all about just saying, whither thou goest, there goest us. I think that's an extremely serious step for us to have taken. Now, it's understandable that the previous government was talking up the risk of war, as Scott Morrison and Peter Dutton had done, and had talked up the significance of the United States alliance in responding to that, the presumption that the United States would solve our China problem for us. And so if you start from those assumptions, then aligning yourself absolutely with the United States makes perfect sense. But for all the reasons we've been discussing, yeah, I think it actually makes perfect nonsense.
Yeah. Okay. So one of the features of foreign and defence policy in Australia going back decades is that it is essentially bipartisan policy. What do you think we can expect from the Albanese government? We have, I think significantly, a foreign affairs minister now who was born in Asia. And so when she goes to meet Asian leaders, they're speaking with someone who was born in their region. I don't know whether you think that's significant. But more to the point, does it look like we have a government in Australia prepared to take a different view of the US, for example, of China, a view closer to the kind of assessment that you think we should be making?
I'm pessimistic about that so far. We have certainly seen very robust bipartisanship between the two sides of politics on these issues for a long time, and that's a bad thing. But bipartisanship is great when you're bipartisan around a good policy. You know, there's a bipartisanship that we don't do capital punishment in Australia. That's good, okay? But it's not so good when bipartisanship is just a way of avoiding debates you don't want to have. And I think what's happened in Australian, in the Australian body politic in the last few decades, really, is that as the challenge of dealing with China has become tougher and starker, there has been an agreement on both sides of politics that they don't really want to debate these issues. And I think in particular on the Labor side, there's been a great reluctance, which in some ways, Tim, goes all the way back to the traumatic experiences Labor had on foreign policy and defence issues in the 50s and 60s, a great reluctance to allow any daylight to appear between themselves and the conservative side of politics. And as you could say that, you know, over the years since 2017, since this issue became really critical, Labor has made, you know, a very clear policy decision, political decision, that it was going to stick as closely to the government as it could. That worked as a political strategy, but it's meant that it's come to office with no policy it can really call its own on these issues. So the question is, now that they're in government, are they going to start thinking differently? Well, we can see some differences. I think it is clear, I think the historians will judge, that under Morrison in the years since, and Turnbull in the years since 2017, but particularly Morrison since March or April 2020, the government was deliberately provoking China in order to achieve domestic political effects. I don't see signs of Labor doing that.
Can I just interrupt there and say, is that because Australians want to see their government standing up to China because they see China as a bit of a bully in the region?
Yes, that's exactly right, and it's completely understandable. So as a piece of psychology, it's understandable. I just don't think it's good statecraft, because what lies behind that approach is a belief that it doesn't matter if we poke China in the eye because the Americans are going to sort them out for us. And once you lose confidence in that very comforting idea, then you have to ask a different question. It's like, where is the relationship with China going? There's no part of my argument. I think the Chinese are nice, or at least the Chinese leadership are nice people. They're not. But our challenge is to find a way to live with them
I think that many people are probably thinking now about, so where does that leave us in terms of what does a kind of pragmatic defence and foreign policy look like that takes into account the inevitability of China's rise, that takes into account what you're saying is the inevitability of America's decline in the region? And in the final chapter of your essay, in terms of the mess, as you describe it, that we now find ourselves in security terms, you say there are five steps that we need to follow to get out of it. Let me just summarise some of those and I'll get you to comment. Firstly, we need to get real about the situation we're in, stop underestimating China and overestimating the US. We need to build a more balanced and realistic view of China and learn to live with them as a regional hegemon. We need to think very seriously about war. The danger is real, and we've not even spoken about really the prospects of nuclear war because these are two nuclear powers. You say Australia needs to have a good chat to America about its future in Asia. Make it clear that they can't expect our support unless they have some clear, achievable objectives. We need to recast our diplomacy in Asia. I think you've spoken a bit about that. And we need to start talking to China. That's a menu of things. We could speak for an hour or more on that alone. But perhaps you could just respond, because I think they're the key parts of a new strategic vision, if you like.
You know, the first point is to get real about the situation we're in. George Orwell once said that the hardest thing to do is to see what's straight in front of your face. And, you know, the points we've been touching on, the scale of China's rise, the extraordinary nature of the challenge that poses to America. We have underestimated China every step of the way. So we need to start taking that seriously. And we've also overestimated America. We did it when we went into Iraq. We did it when we went into Afghanistan. You could say we did it when we went to Vietnam as well. We're doing it again now. It's an old mistake. It's not that America is not a strong country, and it's not that America can't do some good things for us, but it can't do what we're expecting it to do for us because we're overestimating. So we need to just get those basic facts right. We do need to talk to America about that. It's never been part of my argument that we should just walk away from the US alliance. But I do think we need to be very realistic about what the US alliance can do for us, and also realistic about the possibility that it might end up doing nothing for us, not because we've walked away from it, but because the Americans have walked away from it, because they've walked away from East Asia. You know, we are at the moment encouraging America to think through things like AUKUS and our rhetoric that we will back them no matter what. And if, for example, a war does flare over Taiwan and Joe Biden or his successor gives poor Anthony Albanese a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning and Albo finds himself facing a really difficult choice, and he decides, actually, we'd rather not join a war which America's not going to win and which could easily go nuclear. Well, that's a really bad time to say that. If you're not going to be with them, it's much better to let them know well in advance. And so we should be having conversations with the United States now about those sorts of issues, because that's going to be the way in which we can do what we should do. That is, do whatever we can to preserve as strong a relationship with the United States as we can. The third thing is we do start need to getting keeping China in perspective. One of the things that's gone wrong in Australia is that we've swung from thinking that China's no problem at all to talking about silent invasion and all that sort of stuff. And I do think some of that has got seriously exaggerated. It's not that China's not going to want to influence what goes on in Australia. Of course they will. And it's not that they're not going to be intrusive and more intrusive than they like. They will be. They are being. But it's not the case that China, I think, poses an imminent threat to destroy our political system. I don't think they have the power to do that, and I don't think they have any reason to do that. So I think we need to get a nuanced view of the kind of challenge that China poses to us, which neither underestimates it, as we used to, or overestimates it, as we do now.
That was Hugh White, author of the quarterly essay, Sleepwalk to War. More information about Hugh and his books can be found at the Big Ideas homepage. Thanks to Readings Bookstore in Melbourne. That's it for today. I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.